Bicentennial 7.
Welcome to Bicentennial 7. This Bicentennial series is produced by the Humanities Series Midwestern Center and funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities. In this seventh program, the ethnic impact of the Dutch on our American civilization is the topic of Mr. Willard Wickers, curator of the Netherlands Museum in Holland, Michigan.
Our story begins in the summer of 1609, when people from the Netherlands first met the residents of what is now the United States, the Indians. The government of the Netherlands had chartered the United East India Company to expand trade with the East Indies. The company outfitted one of their ships, the Half Moon, and engaged the English skipper, Henry Hudson, to sail with a cargo to the Islands of Spicery, as they were called. The route to the East Indies around the Cape of Good Hope was long and hazardous. Dutch traders often talked about finding a new way to the Indies. Hudson had tried before. Lifting anchor on April 6, 1609, he sailed north and then westward, coming to Newfoundland on July 1st. Continuing down along the coast, they sighted Sandy Hook and dropped anchor on September 3rd in the mouth of the river, which later would bear his name. Passing through the Narrows, the Half Moon sailed on the river never seen before by a European. The shore was wild and mysterious, and at night the Indians built fires to keep animals away. At a point thought to be near Albany, where the river narrows, in disappointment, Hudson turned back. While Hudson's dream of finding a new passage to the Pacific had not been realized, his voyage gave the Dutch a very important claim to a big portion of the New World. Lured by glowing reports of opportunities for bartering with the Indians for furs, several ships of traders followed the route of the Half Moon, and a brisk trade with the Indians developed. By March of 1614, the government formulated requirements for trade, and 13 firms joined in organizing the New Netherland Company. They chose Castle Island in the Hudson River, south of present-day Albany, where they established their trading post and erected Fort Nassau. This Dutch settlement was the second European community in the New World, Jamestown having been founded a few years before. 6 years later, the Pilgrims landed in Massachusetts. In 1618, the government opened trading to all, and Fort Nassau bustled with activity. On June 3, 1621, the West India Company was organized with a 24-year charter, an enormous capital for those times of 7 million guilders, and vast powers which even included authority to declare war and make treaties. What caused this action? The Netherlands and Spain were at war. A truce which had lasted 12 years was cracking, and the two powers were preparing to resume hostilities. The West India Company was a commercial venture as well as a political arm of the government, but trade and profit was the chief goal. At the time, the Dutch Republic was one of the richest nations of the West. Riches poured in from the East Indies, and there were opportunities and jobs in abundance. Profits on trade were far more profitable than slow and uncertain return from crops. There was no great incentive to migrate. The chief elements for emigration were absent, those of poverty and persecution. It was just too comfortable to stay at home. We must remember that the Dutch Republic was the only democratic country in Europe during this time and was an asylum for all refugees. The Puritans from England, Protestant Huguenots from France, Jews expelled from Spain and Portugal, and others. Given the company's priority on trade, they did need settlers to support expanding activities. Trading posts were established, forts were built to protect them against raids, and traders and soldiers needed to be fed. On March 31, 1624, a ship embarked carrying some 30 families and a number of single men. This we might describe as the first Dutch emigrant ship. Some families were established at Castle Island and Fort Orange on the west side of the Hudson. Others were placed on the Delaware and Connecticut rivers. The next year, the company began building Fort Amsterdam and decided the new town around it would be named New Amsterdam. The Indians on the islands were hunters and fishers, and the concept of land ownership was unknown to them. Yet in 1626, Governor Peter Minuit concluded his famous deal and purchased the island for about $27 of merchandise. After all, the directors of the West India Company were legal-minded men, and they wanted a deed in their files. Reflecting the enthusiasm of the new settlers, one immigrant wrote,
"Here we found beautiful rivers, bubbling fountains flowing down into the valleys, basins of running waters in the flatlands, agreeable fruits in the woods, such as strawberries, pigeon berries, walnuts, and wild grapes. The woods abound with acorns for feeding hogs and with venison. There is considerable fish in the rivers, good tillage land. Here especially is free coming and going, without fear of the naked natives of the country. Had we cows, hogs, and other cattle fit for food, which we daily accept in the first ships, we would not wish to return to Holland, for whatever we desire in the paradise of Holland is here to be found. If you will come hither with your family, you will not regret it."
Reports like that encouraged others, and the next year, 45 immigrants arrived with 3 shiploads of livestock. The very elaborate steps to assure care of these animals during the long sea voyage is fascinating, and I should like to share the account of the Dutch writer Wassenaar.
Special care had been taken in conveying the farm animals. The cows and horses were distributed over 2 ships of 140 lasts. Each animal had its own stall with a floor of 3 feet of sand and a special attendant who was to receive a premium if he delivered his charge alive. Each ship carried 300 tons of fresh water, which was pumped up for the cattle. A third ship was added so that should the voyage continue longer than the customary 6 weeks, nothing would be wanting. 2 months later, a flyboat was equipped carrying sheep, hogs, wagons, plows, and all other implements of husbandry.
The company, however, was well aware of their political and military role. In 1628, Piet Hein, with 31 ships, captured the so-called Spanish Silver Fleet of 15 vessels off the coast of Cuba. The cargo of silver, gold, pearls, sugar, fine woods, and beautiful furs sold in Holland for about 15 million guilders. Is it any wonder that the company directors were more interested in such exploits than the uncertain financial return of colonization? The company's choice of governors for New Netherlands was in the main unfortunate. Walter van Twiller, for instance, drank to excess, neglected reports to the company, and was recalled because he failed to return a profit. To his credit, he developed an honest and wholesome relationship with the Indians. While Van Twiller was a weak governor, his successor was quite the opposite. Wilhelmus Kieft was described as a 17th century Little Caesar, lacking Caesar's genius. He was energetic, but had few scruples. His cruel and ruthless acts brought protests from all parts of New Netherlands. He made stupid blunders, the greatest of which brought Indian reprisals for a generation. He had levied a tax which the Indians deemed unjust and refused to pay. Instead of negotiating, Kieft perpetrated a massacre, murdering 80 Indians in a single night, many while they slept. This wanton cruelty and stupidity caused a revulsion in New Netherlands and in Democratic Holland as well. Kieft was immediately recalled, but lost his life in a shipwreck on the return voyage. The last governor, Peter Stuyvesant, who the Indians called Wooden Leg, was in office from 1647 until 1664. He was conscientious, honest, somewhat autocratic and stubborn, but reliable. As a strong man of the frontier, his administration was an effective one. When Stuyvesant took office, it was estimated that some 700 persons were living in New Amsterdam. When Stuyvesant surrendered to the British in 1664, 1,500 persons resided there. 350 houses had been erected. There were two windmills, a church, and many inns. Stuyvesant's first inclination was to resist the British ultimatum to surrender, but the formidable British fleet made the odds unattractive. He decided on delaying tactics in negotiating the terms of surrender, which in the end were quite mild. The colonists accepted the change in the name of their town from New Amsterdam to New York. They were free to keep their Reformed church, but while public officials were required to swear allegiance to King Charles II, the new subjects of the British Crown were allowed to elect their own administrators. These councillors of New York, with typical Dutch business acumen, sought and were granted trading privileges under the British Navigation Acts. New Amsterdam had been founded for trade, and historically this important economic characteristic would always belong to New York. When the British assumed control of the New Netherlands colony, the population had grown to about 10,000, and there were numerous settlements along the Hudson River, at the mouth of the Delaware, and on Long Island, as well as in New Jersey. Many historians, in their interpretation of the New Netherlands era, have made the point that the Dutch had won a bridgehead on the edge of a vast, unexplored world. The odds were better than even. In view of the strategic importance of the harbor of New Amsterdam, they had a base from which Dutch civilization might have fanned out over the continent. In his essay, It Might Have Been, Professor Arnold Mulder observes,
"For a brief moment in the story of mankind, Holland gave evidence of a blind impulse to impart its culture to the whole of the North American continent. The Dutch, with a culture that was the highest in Europe at that time, were searching out a pathway which Dutch trade and culture might travel during centuries to come."
In summarizing the contributions or impact the Dutch presence in the New World made on the great country of which we are today's citizens, certainly trade, flourishing with the doctrine of freedom of the seas, was an important factor. But perhaps the greatest contribution was a legacy which outlasted Dutch rule. An enlightened Dutch culture where a spirit of tolerance prevailed, reflecting that of the Netherlands. Shortly before the surrender of New Amsterdam, a visitor wrote that he found 18 languages spoken there and large numbers of Lutherans, Quakers, Jews, and others. It was a cosmopolitan town with a social atmosphere in sharp contrast with the blue laws of New England. During this very period of an enlightened spirit in New Netherlands, witch trials were being held in New England. During the British period between 1664 and 1776, few Dutch immigrants arrived in America. There were always some families, of course, who joined relatives and friends in the towns founded in New Netherlands. British policy was aimed at anglicizing the Dutch communities, but the spirit of the Dutch Republic prevailed. The Dutch language and church worship services was widely used. In fact, it even outlasted the British rule, continuing in Albany until 1782 and at Kingston until 1808. Thus, the cultural identity of the Dutch in America was maintained. In 1790, there were more than 100,000 people of Dutch origin in the original 13 colonies, 85,000 of whom still lived in the boundaries of the former New Netherlands. One remarkable group of Dutch immigrants organizing settlements under British rule should be mentioned for the impact it may have had on the course of history. William Penn, whose mother was Dutch, visited Holland in 1671 and 1677 and succeeded in winning a number of converts to Quakerism. Penn organized monthly meetings and began an advertising campaign with the hopes of attracting immigrants. 5 pamphlets were translated into Dutch and circulated between 1681 and 1686. Between 1683 and 1690, converts to Quakerism from various cities in the Netherlands founded Germantown. Although Quakers were in the majority, of the 44 families in the settlement, 16 were the Reformed Church. Germantown remained Dutch until the 18th century, when German immigration gained momentum. Of special significance is the first declaration against slavery in America and, as far as is known, in the world, drawn up by these Dutch settlers. A century and a half ahead of the events of the mid-1800s, this declaration, issued on February 18, 1688, read,
"There is a saying that we should do all men like as we will be done ourselves, making no difference of what generation, descent, or color they are. And those who steal or rob men, and those who buy or purchase them, are they not all alike? Here is liberty of conscience, which is right and reasonable. Here ought to be likewise liberty of the body, except for evildoers, which is another case."
At this point in the history of the New World, the profound influence of the Dutch is evident in the attitudes of growing resistance to the British Crown, leading to the Declaration of Independence. While events in the New World were leading to self-rule, in the Netherlands, the climate of democracy, which prevailed during the glorious years of the 17th century, was reverting to a patriarchal attitude with a few noble families ruling the country with decreasing responsiveness to the people. Writing about the Dutch Republic in this period, Hans Koenigsberger describes it as suffering severely from petrification. Dutch intellects, influenced by the writings of French philosophers like Voltaire and Rousseau, opposed the Dutch oligarchy. The American Revolution provided the necessary spark in the Netherlands to ignite the growing restlessness into a widespread desire to regain a greater voice in government. The Dutch government was forced to respond. The prevailing attitude of the Dutch people evoked a natural interest and support of the American Revolution. Amsterdam merchants, with a long tradition of freedom of trade on the seas, took up contact with the American rebels in 1775. The center of trade became the Dutch island, St. Eustatius, in the Caribbean, from which the new republic was supplied. On December 16, 1776, Johan de Graaf, governor of the island, fired a 13-gun salute to the first American ship to enter the harbor, the Andrea Doria. The enraged British lodged vehement protests with the States General of the Netherlands. The governor was recalled, questioned, and immediately reinstated. The Dutch stadtholder, Prince William V, a friend and relative of the English king, tried to preserve the century-old alliance with England. But strong sentiment in Holland for recognition of the United States was intensified when France voted recognition. Faced with this dilemma, the States General began secret negotiation with the Americans, drafting a treaty of trade and friendship in 1778, effective with Holland's recognition of the United States independence. When Benjamin Franklin became ambassador to Paris in 1776, his agent, Charles Dumas, secretly negotiated with Dutch banking firms to handle finances of the American Revolutionary government. Amsterdam merchants also pledged financial support. Meantime, trade between the Dutch at St. Eustatius and the Americans reached large proportions, and the British were determined to end it. British Admiral Rodney, flying the American flag on his ship, tricked the Dutch and conquered the island in 1778. The British continued flying the Dutch flag over the island and thus trapped numerous American and Dutch ships. It was an important victory for the British, captured vast stores of strategic war material. The British increased diplomatic pressure on Prince William V. In anger, they recalled their ambassador to The Hague, and war was a certainty. At this point, the American cause looked anything but promising. Charleston was lost. Benedict Arnold had betrayed the revolution, and General Gates had been defeated. Dutch support of the American cause was not without its price. After the British declared war on Holland, the Dutch could offer the Americans little military aid. In the naval battle with the British in 1780, the Dutch fleet suffered severe losses. The terms of the peace treaty with England in 1784 weakened the Netherlands, and among other conditions, they had to cede their territory in India. In spite of the bleak outlook for the fledgling republic, Dutch support never wavered. John Adams was sent as ambassador to Holland and negotiated a 5 million guilder loan. The States General voted recognition of the American Republic in 1782. Upon winning independence in 1783, most of the much-needed financial support for the new nation came from the Netherlands. By 1794, the total loan had risen to 30 million guilders and represented the total foreign debt of the United States. Additional Dutch funds were invested in banks, canal companies, and manufacturing plants. Two great Americans give tribute to the Dutch support in the American Revolution. Benjamin Franklin stated,
"In love of liberty and in the defense of it, Holland has been our example."
John Adams wrote, he was proud
to have torn from England's bosom a faithful ally by availing himself of the still small voice of reason, without money, without intrigue.
After American independence, waves of immigrants left their homeland for the purpose of a new life.
Standing in the heat, refreshment doth require. He dare not stop to drink or eat, or out will go his fire. But I can leave just when I please, and eat my fill, and take my ease. Ta-dee-da-dum, ta-da. From left to right my grindstone spins, and thus my work begins. Tra-la-la-la-la-la-la-la. The cobbler sits there at his bench until his knuckles crack. He cannot rest to ease his cramp or stretch his aching back. But I in peace enjoy my meals while he's a slave to soles and heels. Ta-dee-da-dum, ta-da. From left to right my grindstone spins, and thus my work begins. Tra-la-la-la-la-la-la-la. The miller in his cloud of flour is scarcely worth a groat. For all he gets he spends on wine to wet his dusty throat. But I in comfort pass the day and win my bread the honest way. Ta-dee-da-dum, ta-da. From left to right my grindstone spins, and thus my work begins. Tra-la-la-la-la-la-la-la. So friends, I think you'll all agree that every trade is fine. But if you want the best of all, you surely must choose mine. What matter if on straw I sleep, for cheerfully I earn my keep. Ta-dee-da-dum, ta-da. From left to right my grindstone spins, and thus my work begins. Tra-la-la-la, tra-la-la-la.
It's perhaps fitting that we concentrate on the enormous obstacles of Enrolley's colony in Michigan. The initial party arrived in winter, a bad time for settlement. The site of the colony was remote, and it was difficult to reach the nearest towns for food and supplies. The dense forest and impenetrable swamps of Michigan were a startling contrast to the flat and cultivated terrain at home. Felling giant trees and clearing the land for agriculture was a gargantuan task. The problem was complicated by the influx of arriving immigrants, including 400 in the Zeeland Party who arrived in June under the leadership of Cornelius Vandermeulen. In March of 1847, there were 43 Dutchmen in the colony. By October, the number had increased to 1,700. This promised land was a wilderness, a forest of undrained, swamps, breeding insects. The new immigrants brought smallpox, malaria, and dysentery, which reached epidemic proportions that first summer. At one time, Vinraldi, commenting on the situation, said,
"The whole colony was a wretched sickbed, and there were scarcely sufficient men who were well enough to bury the dead."
Adversity tests strong men, and the people persevered. By the time an orphanage could be completed, the many children orphaned by the epidemic had been adopted into other homes. After this horrible summer, the winter was moderate, and the foundations were laid for the first successful Dutch colony on American soil since the days of the Dutch West India Company. The Volksvergadering was organized and can be compared to the town meeting of New England. Heads of families were required to attend the weekly meeting, and self-help and cooperation were stressed as a guide for living on the frontier. Important issues of the educational, religious, social, and public affairs of the colony were dealt with, as well as personal grievances. The sale of lots in the newly platted village was supervised. Shelters were built for newly arriving immigrants. Roads and bridges were built, and wages and labor regulated. Vinraldi considered Lake Michigan essential for commerce, but the channel to Black Lake was blocked by shifting sand. Determined to improve the outlet, the Volksvergadering assigned each man to work or contribute the equivalent in money towards the project. Soon a township was organized to replace the Volksvergadering, and by 1849 it was functioning. While Vinraldi had selected an area where his people could retain their cultural and spiritual integrity, Americanization was a compelling objective. Americanization by assimilation and not by absorption was the watchword. Illustrative of Vinraldi's interest in Americanization, in the summer of 1848, he arranged with the county clerk to visit the settlement, which resulted in more than 400 persons declaring their intention to become American citizens. In the election of 1852, they voted predominantly the Democratic ticket, but the slavery issue finally drove them into the Republican Party. When President Lincoln appealed for support, 420 Hollanders joined the Union force. Of this number, all but six were volunteers, and with the exception of one man, all had been born in the Netherlands. It would be difficult to find any example of patriotism for an adopted land to equal this. The adversities and sacrifices of the Dutch colony in Michigan are beyond comprehension in our modern society. One setback after another was surmounted with courage and determination. Thus, the legacy of the Dutch influence in the New World, spanning two centuries, had a profound impact on the fledgling United States, and was indeed a backdrop for the great Dutch migration of the 19th century, which was to write a new and glorious chapter in the saga of America.
The Humanities Series Midwestern Center wishes to thank Mr. Willard Wickers for this ethnic study on the Dutch in Michigan. Next time on Bicentennial 8, Dorothy Schweder will offer a historic background on the ethnic impact of the Amish on our American civilization. Bicentennial is produced at the University of Wisconsin Telecommunications Center by Bill Braun.